another friendly transcribed visit with Victor H. Lindlar, brought to you Monday through Friday by the makers of RDX and the makers of Seratan. This is Dale Kennedy saying goodbye until Monday.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
This is Kansas City, KCMO, your friendly voice for Mid-America.
Peck's most famous $5 solid brass lamp sale starts Monday. Peck's purchased an entire factory of large solid brass table lamps, 27 to 32 inches high, that sell regularly for $10, $15, and $20. Now only $5 complete with shade. Shop around for $10, $15, and $20 brass lamps, then come to Peck's. You can buy them now for only $5. It's the biggest bargain in $5 brass lamps in years. It's Peck's for lamps, it's Peck's for mirrors.
We take you now to Columbia, Missouri, for the MU commencement exercises at which President Truman is featured speaker. The ceremonies are now in progress.
Showing the methods with which criminals work and how our federal agents track them.
A marvelous occasion for this town of some 30,000 people, including the students at the University of Missouri and the two other colleges here. Now then, Harold Douglas has gained a vantage point up by the speaker's stand and will give you the arrangement of the honored guests seated on the stand.
The seating arrangement on the front row of the stage as President Frederick A. Middlebush, as the principal person on the stage, that is, he's in the middle of the stage, right in front of the rostrum. Seated to his left is President Truman, and on the left end of the row of five chairs is Senator McReynolds. Governor Smith is seated to the right of President Middlebush, and Reverend Seth Slaughter, who rendered the invocation, is seated on the extreme right end of that row of five chairs. Now the rain is beginning to fall rather hard, and some of the spectators are beginning to leave the stadium and perhaps go back under the seats. Now the band has just completed playing of its final piece before the president speaks, and it's just about time for President Frederick A. Middlebush of the University of Missouri to stand and introduce President Truman, who will deliver the commencement address here today. We take you now to the rostrum.
Members of the graduating class, families and friends of graduating members of this class, and ladies and gentlemen, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce to you as your commencement speaker, the President of the United States of America.
President, members of the faculty, distinguished guests, and the class of 1950, I'm very glad to take part in these graduation exercises at the University of Missouri. The young men and women graduating here today deserve congratulations, for they have proved that they are able to think for themselves and to work hard day by day to reach a truly worthwhile goal. These university graduates and their fellows at other schools all across our country should be congratulated for another reason, too. They should be congratulated because they are entering a world of greater opportunities than young people have ever entered before. You hear a lot of talk these days to the effect that the world is full of dangers, and that our civilization is heading straight for disaster. Of course the world's full of danger. The world always has been full of danger for people in every country and at every period of history. As men have gained more scientific knowledge, the dangers which could come from the misuse of that knowledge have grown greater. But by the same token, the opportunities for human advancement have also become greater. Our scientific achievements can be used for good and need not be used for evil. Our civilization need not wind up in disaster. It can go on to greater heights. Those who are frightened and dismayed do not have faith that men will use scientific advances for good ends. They see only the dangers in the world and not the opportunities. But those who understand a free society have faith that we can use our knowledge for human advancement. For the essential meaning of a free society is that free men, facing the practical realities of any situation, can choose the course that will provide for their common protection and advance their common welfare. Our history shows that men working together through the democratic process can find the right solution to new problems. The democratic process is not always easy. It involves us in great public debate. Emotions are aroused and feelings run high. But when the shouting is ended and the decision is taken, the resulting choice rests on the solid foundation of the common wisdom of the people. Dictators and tyrants who thought our political debate indicated indecision and weakness have found to their dismay that instead those debates are a source of wisdom and a sign of strength. The ability of our democratic process to find proper solutions for difficult problems has been dramatically demonstrated again in the last 5 years in the field of foreign policy. When the war ended in 1945, the American people found themselves in a situation unique in their experience. By the circumstances of history, we became the strongest single nation on earth. Most of the other great nations of the world were prostrate. Our help and leadership were essential to assist them to recovery. And their recovery was vital to our own security and prosperity. Furthermore, it soon became clear that one nation did not want to help the world to recovery. Instead, that nation wished to prolong the intensity and intensify the misery of others so that it could gain domination over them. The plain intent of that nation was to overthrow the tradition of freedom, which is shared by our country and many others. In this situation, the United States faced a clear choice, which was debated up and down our land. We could choose to abandon the rest of the free world and try to become strong enough all by ourselves to withstand communist aggression. Or we could choose to work with other countries to build the combined strength necessary not only to withstand aggression, but also to achieve peace and human advancement. You know the outcome of that debate. The overwhelming choice of the American people was and is against the dangerous futility of isolationism and for full cooperation with other nations toward peace and freedom. We've backed that choice with deeds. Our strong support of the United Nations, our vital contribution to the European Recovery Program, our ratification of the North Atlantic Treaty, our military assistance to the common defense of free nations. These and many other actions are part of our strong, positive program to achieve a just and lasting peace. Our program for peace and freedom is necessarily designed at present to build a strong community of free nations which can resist communist aggression, whether that aggression takes the form of internal subversion and external attack. At the same time, our program for peace is designed ultimately to create conditions in which all men and all nations can work together in mutual trust and mutual benefit. Our peace program is designed to bring the free nations together in common action. It is also designed to support the United Nations as the political basis for a world order among all nations. Our peace program includes military security measures through our own efforts and through the combined efforts of the free nations. Those military security measures are defensive only, and we look forward to the day when international forces under the United Nations will keep the peace of the entire world. Finally, our peace program includes economic measures which will make it possible for people to be secure and to lead fuller lives. These measures are necessary at this time to enable the free nations of the world to resist communist imperialism. But our economic measures, as far as possible, are designed so that any nation which sincerely wishes to work for human betterment can join in them. It is about these economic measures in our program for peace and freedom that I speak particularly today. Since the war ended, we have embarked upon a new era of economic cooperation with friendly nations. As this work moves forward, we must appraise our progress from time to time and make new plans for the future. We can't stand still. No nation can stand still. It can only go forward or disintegrate. And we are not disintegrating. You will recall the great purpose that inspired our aid to Europe under the Marshall Plan. We sought to help the countries of Europe restore their war-shattered economies so that their people could once again enjoy a decent standard of living, so that they could protect themselves from totalitarian threats to their security. In short, the purpose of the Marshall Plan was to enable the people of Europe to save their freedom and use their resources for peace. We've always regretted that the communist leaders did not permit the peoples of Eastern Europe to participate in this recovery effort. The results of the European recovery program in the participating countries have been most remarkable. The nations of Western Europe with the Marshall Plan aid are setting new records of production and approaching the restoration of pre-war standards of living. Industrial production in Western Europe has increased 30% in the last 2 years. The diet of the people there has been restored almost to the pre-war level. Furthermore, the countries of Western Europe have been able to get their national finances on a sounder basis and to obtain sufficient goods so that they could lift most of their rationing and price control. They have reduced trade barriers and have increased trade among themselves by 50% in the last 2 years. As a result, there's been a great revival of faith in freedom and hope for the future among the Western European countries. The numbers and the influence of communists within their borders have been steadily receding. In the last 2 years, the communists have received progressively fewer votes in every election held in the Marshall Plan countries. Today, every one of the Marshall Plan countries is stronger and better able to resist communism and to work for peace than at any time since World War II ended. In addition, our aid under the Marshall Plan has indirectly strengthened many countries outside of Europe and has helped to restore the flow of international trade. Despite the steady progress they have made, most of the nations of Western Europe are still not economically self-supporting. If we were to take away our assistance now, they would still be unable to pay for all the things they need to buy from us and from other countries. The result would be a sudden drop in the living standards, weakened defense standards, weakened defense standards, weakened defense standards, weakened defenses, and a greater opportunity for the communists to move in. That must not happen. It would be disastrous for Europe and for us too. Instead, we must keep on working to build the sound economic conditions without which there can be no security or progress for free men. Our work for this purpose will be largely carried on for 2 more years under the Marshall Plan. but our vital national interest in a healthy world economy will not end in 1952. It will be just as necessary then as it is today to have a secure economic foundation for world peace. This secure foundation requires not only a successful recovery from the devastations of war, it requires the kind of dynamic progress which proves that the way of freedom can satisfy the economic needs of man. Economic well-being of other free nations around the world is important to our common effort for peace. It is also important to our own economic well-being. Last year we exported goods worth twelve billion dollars. A large part of them to Europe. These exports consisted of wheat, cotton and tobacco, dried fruits, machine tools and textiles, and many other products of our farms and factories. If our exports are to continue at a high level, other countries must have some means to pay for them.